Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's quarterly market investment update. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. I will be standing by should you need any assistance, and please note today's call is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to investment advisor Mike Navone. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone. I'm Mike Navone, an investment advisor here at Ensemble Capital. Thank you for joining us for our fall 2019 conference call. Today, the focus will be on the recent performance of our portfolio, the current market and economic situation, and a discussion of two of our holdings, Tiffany and MasterCard. Speaking today will be Sean Stannard Stockton, Chief Investment Officer of Ensemble Capital, and Todd Wenning, Senior Investment Analyst.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks everyone for joining us today. Over time, as interest in these updates has grown, we've been hearing from more and more of you who have questions about our process, feedback on our thinking, or simply want to learn more about investing with us. You should always feel free to reach out to us anytime at info@ensemblecapital.com, which we monitor closely and always reply to. The performance of our equity portfolio this quarter was approximately in line with the overall market. While the final calculation of our composite will not be available until later this month, our current estimate is that our equity portfolio composite was up 1.12% versus the S&P 500 up 1.7%. On a year-to-date basis, this brings our equity portfolio composite to up 24.98% versus the S&P 500 up 20.55%. One of the more important drivers of equity returns recently has been something that has not happened. The U.S. has not gone into a recession. Back in the fourth quarter of 2018, many investors began to fear that a recession was near at hand after strong levels of economic optimism had characterized the first 9 months of 2018. But as we pass the one-year anniversary of these fears exploding into the public consciousness, the unemployment rate has remained at low levels, solid rates of economic growth continues, even as the U.S. laps quite strong levels of growth last year, and corporate revenue and earnings have continued to grow. Notably, the decline in home sales that began last summer and was a key sign of potential economic weakness has now reversed and returned to growth. As we discussed in a blog post in November of last year examining the housing weakness, even indicators like declining home sales that have a pretty decent historical record of predicting recessions are not by themselves actually strong evidence that a recession is coming. While the overall U.S. economy has not gone into a recession, the manufacturing and industrial segments of the economy have slowed to a crawl and are running at near recessionary levels. This is actually the third such slowdown over the last 10 years. During both of the past slowdowns, as well as so far this time, consumer spending, which makes up approximately 70% of the U.S. economy, has remained resilient. In our own portfolio, we have MasterCard trading near all-time highs as the company directly benefits from consumer spending, with management saying that they see continued growth. On the other hand, we have Landstar Systems, which facilitates transportations of goods shipped via big rig trucks. The company's flatbed segment specializes in moving heavy equipment used in manufacturing and industrial industries, and the slowdown in these end markets is evident in the company's financial results. But as is normal, the drivers of our portfolio performance this past quarter were primarily company-specific items rather than macro trends. Notable areas of strength in our portfolio during the third quarter included TransDigm, up 14%, Google, which rallied by 13%, and First American Financial, which gained 11%. TransDigm's gains were driven by positive updates from the company on the integration of a large acquisition they completed recently. The strength in Google came from a strong earnings report, which calmed market concerns related to the previous quarter, in which the company missed earnings expectations. And First American stock benefited from the rebound in housing sales that I referenced. The primary source of weakness in our portfolio was Netflix, which fell 27%. We also saw modest declines of 5% and 3% respectively in Ferrari and Oracle. The decline in Netflix stock was caused by weaker than expected new subscriber additions in the most recent quarter and investor concerns about competition from Disney Plus launching in November. We've written extensively about Netflix. But in short, we believe that the weaker-than-expected subscriber results was within the range of normal volatility seen by the company after raising prices, and we believe that Disney Plus will do well, but a slate of blockbuster movies and kids' TV shows will be an addition to not a replacement for, a Netflix subscription. The declines in Ferrari and Oracle were relatively modest, with Ferrari's decline more a consolidation of gains earlier in the year. The stock is still up over 50% this year, while Oracle declined some on renewed concerns about their shift to software as a service business model, and yet the stock still remains up over 20% so far this year. Those numbers are through the end of the most recent quarter. Later during this call, Todd and I will be discussing two of the holdings in our portfolio in more depth. However, in addition to clients being interested in the positions in the portfolio, we are often asked why we don't own certain companies. Given we own a focused portfolio of 15 to 30 stocks, we spend a significant amount of time researching any company before it enters our portfolio, and then we continue to engage in rigorous research as long as we are shareholders. So sometimes the answer to why we don't own a certain company is as simple as the stock in question has never made it to the top of our priority list. But we also research and ultimately pass on many potential investments that are perfectly good companies. Back in the beginning of 2018, we published an in-depth discussion of why we chose not to invest in a company called Ecolab, despite concluding that it was a perfectly solid company. Today, Todd is going to describe in more general terms entire classes of stocks that come close to meeting our requirements for investment, but which we ultimately declined to purchase. In a focused portfolio, what you don't own can have a significant impact on performance, and so we wanted to lay out the process by which we choose to avoid stocks that at first glance may appear to be great companies.
Thanks, Sean. Sean, Arif, and I recently created a diagram that distills our investment philosophy into a few core principles. In a recent blog post introducing the diagram, I noted that three factors must be in place before we would consider investing in a company: a competitive moat protecting the company from competition, strong management, and forecastability. When one of those factors is missing, we call those investment ideas traps. I thought I'd elaborate on our trap concept here. We've identified three traps we want to avoid. First, the commoditization trap. This is when there's a strong management team in place and an easy-to-understand business, but either a non-existent or narrowing moat. Much of a company's intrinsic value is driven by its so-called terminal value, the value the business will create over the very, very long term. As such, if we're not confident that a company can maintain or widen its economic moat beyond 5 or 10 years, estimating terminal value becomes increasingly difficult. In this circumstance, long-term returns on invested capital and growth, the two pillars of our valuation model, can decline faster than might otherwise be expected. Some investors are comfortable making a bet on the company's decline being slower than the market expectation, and that's another way to make money. But we think that's a dangerous game and one we want to intentionally avoid. The second trap is a stewardship trap. This is when there's evidence of a durable moat and an easy-to-understand business, but we lack confidence in management. We live in a hyper-competitive economy where cheap and abundant capital and new advertising platforms have made it easier than ever for challengers, whether that's a startup or Amazon, to take on lazy incumbents and chip away at their business. Because of this, we require our companies to be managed by what we consider to be good business stewards. Our management teams need to understand how to create sustainable value and thoughtfully allocate capital. The final trap is the complexity trap. This is when we like management and think there's a durable moat, but we just can't get comfortable understanding the business. Sometimes the reason is that we lack requisite domain knowledge in a specialized field. Other times, the financials are opaque, or the business operates in multiple competitive arenas and we struggle to grasp unit economics. Before investing in any company, we want to appreciate the known risks and the so-called known unknowns about the business, and a lack of understanding prevents us from achieving this. To be sure, there are a lot of good companies that fall into one of these traps. They might even make good investments at the right price, but our aim is to own great businesses, and then of course pay a reasonable price for them. Because we manage a concentrated portfolio of between 15 and 30 companies, we must be selective and stay true to our strategy. Hopefully this discussion provides a glimpse into the rigor of our investment process. Back to you, Sean.
So we know that there are a lot of good companies that we don't own, and our goal isn't to have an informed opinion on every stock in the market, but only to find 15 to 30 stocks that possess all of the characteristics that we look for and also trade at a discount to what we believe they're worth. The truth is, stock picking is really hard. While there are lots of stocks that we think might be good investments, we're looking for a very select group of stocks where we think the odds are stacked heavily in our favor. Sticking to the discipline Todd just described is critical to our process. So Now let's talk about a company we've owned in our portfolio for a long time, and which we believe ranks near the top of our portfolio in terms of meeting and exceeding our requirements in each of the core areas of our assessment process. MasterCard is a company that pretty much everyone has heard of. In fact, if you're listening to this call or reading the transcript, no matter where you live in the world, as long as it's not China, there's a very good chance you have a MasterCard in your wallet or purse. If you don't, then you almost certainly have a Visa card. You probably have both. These two companies hold an effective duopoly on the processing of credit and debit payments. Importantly, these companies do not lend any money. If you look at your credit or debit card, you'll find that it's issued by a bank. And if it has the name of a non-bank company on it, such as American Airlines or Apple, these companies have just partnered with a bank to issue the card. In American Airlines' case, it's Citibank, and the new Apple credit card is issued by Goldman Sachs. The issuing bank is the one whose checking account a debit card is tied to, and they're the ones lending the money to fund credit card payments. On the other side of the transaction is the merchant and its bank. No matter whether you swipe your card or wave your Apple Watch with Apple Pay, or use PayPal to process a payment via your credit or debit card, or use Google Pay or Amazon Pay to facilitate an online transaction, in each case, your bank and the merchant's bank need to exchange information across a communication network, and that network is almost always provided by Visa or MasterCard. While you might hear about how merchants pay 2% or more in credit card fees, Visa and MasterCard are only collecting about 1/20th of that fee, with the banks, the ones taking the credit risk, earning the bulk of the fee. Americans are so used to using debit and credit cards that it's easy to lose sight of how amazing the Visa and MasterCard networks are. The fact is, when you walk into a store anywhere in the United States, you take it for granted that the merchant will allow you to swipe a little piece of plastic with either the MasterCard or Visa logo on it, and then they will let you walk out with your purchase. The reason you carry a Visa or MasterCard is because you know that they are accepted everywhere. And the reason they are accepted everywhere is because everyone carries one. So this is a classic example of a chicken and egg problem. Before everyone accepted these cards, it was difficult to convince consumers to carry one. And before everyone carried one, it was difficult to get merchants to accept them. Having solved this problem, MasterCard and Visa now have a competitive moat around their business, which makes it very difficult for any new company to compete with them. Recently, I was at a Target in the middle of Silicon Valley. At the checkout stand, I noticed a sticker advertising that they accepted Alipay, the payment network founded by the Chinese company Alibaba. When I asked the cashier how often people used Alipay, she actually didn't know what I was talking about. Despite having noticed the sticker, no manager had ever thought to explain it to her, and no customer had ever asked to use it. Why wasn't she trained on how to process Alipay transactions? Because her manager knows that few people carry this form of payment. And why don't customers carry this form of payment? Because few stores accept it. So building a globally accepted payment network was hard in the past. But today it's even harder because not only must a new company in the payment industry solve the chicken and egg problem themselves, but now that it has already been solved, a new competitor must solve the problem in a way that is much better than the existing solution. So let's finish looking at MasterCard through the lens that Todd just introduced, moat, management, and forecastability. First of all, we think MasterCard has a very strong moat for the reasons just explained. We also think this moat will remain valuable because we think it is highly likely that a decade or more from now, the service MasterCard provides will remain critical to facilitating commerce and valuable to both merchants and consumers. We also believe that MasterCard's management is top-notch. Not content to sit still and milk cash earnings from their network, MasterCard's management team is forging ahead into business-to-business transactions. While a large portion of consumer transactions occur via cards, business-to-business transactions, the payment of invoices to vendors and other payments between businesses, is still a slow manual process. So MasterCard has been investing earnings from their credit and debit network into solving the B2B payments problem. They've also been aggressively forging ahead in emerging markets, where they've been a leader in using new technologies and adopting their systems to local markets. While Americans are used to their cards being accepted everywhere, in India, the birthplace of MasterCard's CEO, and a country with a population 4 times larger than the United States, only 5% of merchants accept credit cards. With the chicken and egg problem not yet solved in this country, as well as some other emerging markets, the competition is fierce, but the opportunity for MasterCard is very large. Despite reinvesting in their businesses, MasterCard produces far more excess cash than they need to grow the business. So we're also glad they've shown themselves to be smart capital allocators of capital. Buying back significant levels of their own stock at very attractive prices, paying a dividend, and increasing the amount of debt in their capital structure in a prudent manner. Finally, we believe the company's long-term economics, and thus the value of the business, is reasonably forecastable. This is partially because of the domain expertise that our team has built up over the years and our confidence that we have a strong understanding of the payments industry in which MasterCard operates. But just as importantly, it's because we believe MasterCard's business to demonstrate high levels of intrinsic forecastability. While some companies are subject to highly unpredictable changes in macro factors, such as an oil company being dependent on the price of oil, MasterCard's business is driven by far more stable trends. The key metric for them is global consumer spending, which even during recessions does not decline by more than a couple percentage points, and which we are confident will grow at a modest but steady rate over the very long term. On top of that growth driver, the company benefits from the relentless shift to consumer spending from cash and checks to credit and debit. While it might seem that much of this shift has already played out in developed markets, we can look to near cashless countries like Sweden to see that even U.S. consumers are likely to see continued declines in the use of cash and checks. I had a little example in my own life recently when a utility company emailed to say that rather than directly billing my credit account, my checking account for my monthly bill, they're now offering the option to have my bill linked to my credit card. In the Bay Area, we see more and more new stores opening which simply do not accept cash payments. Of course, while we have very high levels of conviction in MasterCard, it doesn't come close to being a risk-free investment. All investments in equities involve accepting relatively high levels of uncertainty. It is the requirement of accepting uncertainty that explains why stocks offer higher rates of returns than bonds. But in seeking investments for our focused portfolio, we require every company to exhibit relatively low levels of uncertainty compared to the average public company on the core issues of the longevity and relevance of their competitive positioning, the management team's capabilities in creating economic value and allocating their excess cash flow, and both the intrinsic forecastability of the business as well as our own team's capabilities and circles of confidence.
When we think about luxury goods, two things tend to come to mind. First, we tend to think of European brands like Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. In fact, according to the consulting firm Deloitte, French, Italian, and Swiss companies together accounted for just under half of global luxury goods sales in 2017. Second, we tend to recognize a luxury brand when we see one. A Ferrari, for example, is unmistakable, as are Louis Vuitton handbags with their ubiquitous LV insignias. That's largely the point in purchasing a luxury item, of course, to communicate status to others. Curiously, Tiffany does not fall into either of those buckets. It's one of just a few global American luxury brands, and the casual observer cannot tell a Tiffany diamond engagement ring from one purchased elsewhere. There's no room on a diamond for logo placement, after all. So how does Tiffany do it? Like its European luxury counterparts, Tiffany is draped in a wonderful narrative and history. You might be as surprised as I was to learn, for instance, that Tiffany has been around since 1837 and has been in the diamond business since 1848, when Charles Louis Tiffany opportunistically purchased diamonds from fleeing French aristocrats in the French Revolution of 1848. His timing couldn't have been better, as new American millionaires clamored for royal jewelry to show off their recently achieved status. That's what got the ball rolling. As a company, Tiffany is older than Cartier, founded in 1847, Louis Vuitton, founded in 1854, and Burberry, founded in 1856. This durability matters in luxury because it communicates a brand's ability to endure all kinds of major socioeconomic changes and remain relevant over successive generations. It also communicates a certain timelessness of core products that remain in fashion despite intermittent fads and trends. Tiffany is one of the few brands in the world that can be identified by a color alone. Its trademarked robin egg blue provides instant recognition from near or far, and that color communicates elegance, exclusivity, and sophistication. To be sure, more than one would-be suitor has tried his hand at putting a non-Tiffany item in a Tiffany blue box to achieve the desired effect. It's a risky move, of course, for if the ring doesn't fit, you have some explaining to do when the recipient needs to have it resized. But that speaks to the power of the Tiffany brand, that the color of the box can multiply the value of what's inside it. Assuming the item was properly acquired, a Tiffany ring in a Tiffany blue box communicates to the recipient that you're worth the extra money. Tiffany's narrative has been carried forward into the modern era by popular media, such as the classic movie Breakfast at Tiffany's, starring Audrey Hepburn, and more recent movies like Sweet Home Alabama and The Great Gatsby. The most recent advertising campaigns feature millennial celebrities like Zoe Kravitz, Lady Gaga, and Elle Fanning. To be sure, the Tiffany brand has been mismanaged at various points in its history. However, we think the current CEO, Alessandro Bogliolo, who joined the company at the end of 2017, has been a fantastic brand steward and is executing well in the areas the company can control. Notably, we are encouraged by his focus on informal luxury to better resonate with the millennial generation. Last year, for instance, Tiffany opened an informal style studio in London's Covent Garden, about a mile away from its ritzy high-end storefront on Old Bond Street. The style studio format is more informal than the main store, with barstool seating, fragrance dispensers, and opportunities to interact with and customize Tiffany-branded jewelry. We think this is a healthy way for Tiffany to reach out to new consumers without diluting the core brand value. Like other luxury brands, Tiffany is seeing growth in emerging Asian economies, some of which are adopting Western-style engagement ring culture. In August, Tiffany announced a partnership with India-based luxury retailer Reliance Brands Limited to open new stores in Delhi and Mumbai. As the CEO of Reliance Brands put it in the press release announcing the deal, Tiffany needs no introduction in India. It is iconic and timeless. That quote brings up an important point about Tiffany's brand-driven moat. As I mentioned earlier, it's extremely challenging to attach a brand and command a related price markup to a piece of jewelry that from a distance cannot be differentiated from a similar item. Given its rich heritage and place in popular culture, Tiffany, as the Reliance Brands CEO put it, needs no introduction. This is a huge advantage for Tiffany against any would-be upstart competitors. In many other areas of the luxury goods market, we've seen direct-to-consumer brand startups leverage social media to take on incumbents. But it's far more difficult to start and scale high-end jewelry, as the product doesn't outwardly advertise the brand. It takes decades, if not generations, to be considered iconic and timeless. And this says nothing about the expensive input costs, gold, platinum, diamonds, skilled artisan wages, that would go into a high-end jewelry operation. In summary, we're confident in Tiffany's moat and have growing confidence in Tiffany's management. We think the company is set up well for continued relevance in future generations. Back to you, Sean.
Well, thank you all for joining us today. We look forward to speaking with you next quarter. And in the meantime, you can follow our writing at intrinsicinvesting.com and on Twitter by searching for Ensemble Capital. Thanks so much.